in the mana, in the rea, in the tangata o te wā. Hēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Greetings and welcome everyone to this special event held here in the Lilac Lounge, which is part of our contribution to Pride time. It seems to be changing its length of time, so I'll just call it Pride time and we'll work it out from there. We will be doing other things, such as next Tuesday we have the card game, set of card games here, and also of course we will have the stall in the Michael Fowler Centre at the later time. So those are our contributions to Pride, and thank you all for coming and being part of that. Later I'll talk to you about the raffle, but not now. Right now, I'd like to introduce our very famous guest, Mia, who will talk to you about what she's done and where she's been and however else you want to describe it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mia.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Carol, and thank you, Alan, for inviting me to speak here at Lilac Library, a very precious space, and as part of Tū Whakahihi e Te Whanganui Atara. Kia ora koutou katoa. My name is Mia Farlane, and I'm a novelist, and I've written three novels. I'm going to be reading an extract from the latest novel that I've written. The title of this evening is Are You Okay? And that is because while I was doing research for this novel, I was asked that question quite a few times. Are you okay? It's going to last for half an hour or a bit less, and I'll be reading a couple of extracts. The first one is about 7 minutes and the next one is half as long. And in between, I'll be speaking a little bit about my writing process, my experience of writing the book. So I've brought along, I know that Lilac Library has a copy already, but I've brought along the Viking edition of my first novel, Footnotes to Sex. And this is the Penguin edition that came out a bit later. Footnotes to Sex is about, if you haven't read it, not knowing what you want to do with your life and idolizing someone who does know what she wants to do with her life. It's set in London and Paris. It's a tragicomedy about a couple in a long-term relationship that's going through a tricky patch, partly because one of the women in this couple is so very busy trying to write a PhD on a woman she idolizes. So that's Footnotes to Sex. And Badisha, the British broadcaster journalist, said something very lovely about it, which I'm going to mention because it does link in with the reading I'm going to do this evening. She says that it is Seinfeld meets Dorothy Parker over a late night hot drink. And I was so happy when she said that. Dorothy Parker, I love her writing. But it's also quite apt that she said it, if you just think of the themes, because my first novel, Footnotes to Sex, is about a flailing relationship, and it's about academic unfulfillment. So it's about people struggling, and Dorothy Parker wrote about people who were struggling. But then Badisha said this about my first book was interesting for me, because then in my second novel that I've written, I'm calling it Crossed Wires, and it's about the phenomenon within families of a pariah, a persona non grata, something that really interests me. And it's also a South London parody of chick lit. It's about failed intimacies, which is a subject that Dorothy Parker wrote about. Now, the last, the most recent novel I've written is called Parallel Hell, and it's about suicide. So here, it's even more like Dorothy Parker, because Dorothy Parker wrote a lot about suicide, and she, in fact, her first poetry collection is called Enough Rope. And she wrote, actually, see if I can find the extract. So Dorothy Parker's humor, she used it like a razor to slash at things. And she writes about the pain of being human. So she wrote about suicide. This inside that poetry collection called Enough Rope, there's a poem called Resume. And the last line is something like, I'm probably going to misquote it, but you may as well live. Because she lists all the awful things that you could, the ways you could try, and they're all painful and they're all awful. You may as well live. That's what she says. So I'm now going to read the first of the two extracts from Parallel Hell. And the only thing you need to know is that it is contemporary and it's about a suicide-obsessed Londoner. That she'd woken up technically anxious was quite odd. It was like she was plugged into the dub-dub-dub universe. Because then she went into work and got a disturbing email that would have had something to do with that time she was hacked 5 or 6 years ago and locked out of her email account. Because budgerigar had not been her password since then. The email went, in summary, I know budgerigar is one of your passwords. Let's get right to purpose. No one has paid me to investigate you. Let me tell you, I installed a software on the X Video Clips website, and do you know what? You visited this website to have some fun. You know what I mean. You have great taste. Lol. And a remote control desktop provided me with access to your display and webcam. My software collected every one of your contacts, and I created a video of you. So you now have two choices. And we should analyze each of these possibilities in details. First solution, skip this email. In such case, I most certainly will send emails to all your contacts. Next alternative, you pay 1,000 USD by Bitcoin. Details below. We will call it a donation. Last point, I've a special pixel with this mail, and right now I know you have read this mail. You have one day to pay. It is a non-negotiable offer. So please do not waste my time and yours by replying. Which was all a bit yuck, not to give it too much weight. A mixture of blackmail and burglary /rape. Although rape might be a bit strong. Violation, perhaps? No one burly had just pinned her down in a car in the dark. Sticks and stones and other objects may break my flesh and bones, but she was an adult now, too, to stay with the positive. So she dealt with the email appropriately, marking it as spam, reporting phishing, whatever that meant, and forwarding it to IT. Nevertheless, 116123. Please hold the line to retain your place in the queue. Thank you. Ding dong, 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 ding dong. The repetition of the ringtone was meditative, like music. Ding dong, ding dong. It was calming, soporific. This was perfect, really, in that what she wanted, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, was to sleep, ding dong, ding dong, which might happen if no one ever answered the phone, Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. They clearly needed volunteers. That was almost 10 minutes. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. Although, as it was 2:15 a.m., this would be within rush hour, she supposed, the downside of being unoriginal. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. 2 or 3 minutes later, a trip in the pattern and, hello, an audible apparition with no lead-in. The voice of an older woman, well into her 80s, the word genteel came to mind, an assumption based on one word and possibly quite wrong. In fact, this woman might be an aging addict with 20 or 30 years clean time and a past as a prostitute in the Netherlands. My name's Roz, the voice said. Is there a name I can call you? Franny, Franny said, no boundaries. But I know someone who volunteers as a Samaritan. Do you know me? No, I don't, said the voice. Said Roz, if that was her name. No, I don't suppose you do. The voice was not the same as the ex-friend's friend, come to think of it. It was similar, but not the same. What's bothering you? This volunteer asked, moving on. They were probably given a sheet with sample starter questions when they trained to go on phones. It was a logical question, though. It made sense. In any case, I'm finding it hard to sleep, Franny said, while a number of frightened and or depressed and or suicidal people held or didn't hold the line. Has anything happened to make you feel anxious? The voice asked. Roz asked. It was like talking to someone in the dark, someone you'd never met before, and chatting with them in the dark. I got an email, Franny said. They had my old password. I was hacked a few years ago, so I suppose they got it then. They said they knew I'd been on X-rated sites, which, it's a scam, said the voice. Roz, as she called herself. Perhaps it was her middle name. I got one exactly the same. They said something about pay by Bitcoin. Oh, that's what I got. Were volunteers advised to lie to make you feel better? That was in the email I got. They said, Roz said, she was more likely a retired nurse from Chichester than a retired escort, I was accessing porn sites and they had all my contacts. They just want money. I've got an old email account I can't get into anymore. I hate to think someone might be squatting in there. Roz said, the trouble with computers is that you feel out of control. She said, the important thing to do is to delete the emails, to delete them. She said, I probably should have reported it to the police, but I just deleted it. Nothing will happen, she said. You're sure? As sure as I can be. I've had the same email. Try not to let it play on your mind, Roz said, and I hope you get some sleep. Gosh, you're up all night listening to people, Franny said, their chat in the dark coming to a close. Well, perhaps not all night. Only until 4, Roz said. It was possible she really was called Roz, and fair enough if she wasn't, if she was happier with a pseudonym. Either way, well, thank you. I'm glad I could be of some help. They said goodbye, and Roz vanished like a fairy godmother, off to the next caller. Thank you. So writing Parallel Hell for me was a really potent experience, a very nothing like the first two books, obviously for three reasons. The first one, the subject. So it's about suicide, and it's not only about suicide, it's about the that point where someone is both suicide-obsessed and bereaved by suicide. So it's a really potent subject to be writing about, and it meant that I had felt a great sense of freedom writing the book, because the subject just took up too much space. It just took up all the space, so I just wrote it. I just could make an assumption here, perhaps, that some of you, at least, will have seen live or Netflix, or perhaps live if you're lucky. I haven't, but Hannah Gadsby's Nanette. I don't know whether any of you have, but I absolutely loved that show. I've seen it more than once, and I really related strongly to what she was doing with the humour there. So she was flipping it, subverting it, using subverted humour about something very serious. So that's the first of the reasons, the subject. So there are two other reasons why it was such a powerful experience writing this book, and that is where it was set. Because halfway through writing Parallel Hell, I was able to, lucky me, take 1 year's unpaid leave from my job at South Bank Centre's National Poetry Library, and that was in 2019. And I came here to Te Whanganui Atara, to Wellington, with my partner. And because I was living in Wellington, in Te Whanganui Atara, I then made the decision, of course, to have my suicide-obsessed Londoner relocate to her hometown. So that was also, it was the first time I'd ever had a character who was born in Aotearoa in New Zealand. So that was interesting in itself. But to then have her move to her hometown, and this is someone who is suicide obsessed. So it's one thing to be in that frame of mind in a huge city, in a huge anonymous city, which remains anonymous whether or not you've been living there for decades, as she had and as I have also. And then it's so very different for her to move to a small town, but it's also her hometown. And so there are possibilities, which I had, for interesting interactions, that she might bump into people from her past, possibly family members, you know, so there's things that were able to happen there. So that is the other reason. Yeah, so, I mean, I've got friends in London who, like me, visit family in their hometown, and not necessarily, obviously, all different places. So someone in north of Scotland, a small place, and, you know, have talked to me about what it's like, to the challenges of being in that situation, having been in a big city. So that's one thing. And the last reason why it was such a potent experience for me is the way I wrote it, the way I happened to write it. So when I was here in 2019, I got a Creative New Zealand grant, and that meant that I was allowed to spend, for the first time, all my time on the book. So I didn't have a part-time job. I did to begin with, but then I got the grant. And so I spent a lot of time with my main character, and we wandered around Wellington together, she and I, as we had in London. And I do use that expression because that's part of my writing method for this book. So it was as if I sort of wandered around with her and partly as her. So I took her to everything to do with suicide, of course, because she was suicide obsessed. So I went to a suicide awareness march, or we went there together. I went to an exhibition on self-harm and suicide as her, almost. And I went to the Wellington Public Library when it was still open, the big one, and took out all of the books on suicide, pretty much, that I could find, and for her, and also to a bookshop, or several bookshops. And I write about my experience of doing this in a piece called Are You Okay? A Writing Event. I'm soon going to read not that piece, but a different one. But so I went to a bookshop to get books on suicide, partly for research for myself and partly as my main character, who was going into a bookshop because she wanted to read everything about it. And the reaction I had from the people in the bookshop, I put into the novel. And I write about that experience in a piece called Are You Okay? A writing event that's in Moxie magazine, which I've read out, by the way, if you'd like to hear it read out on Wellington Access Radio at Quilted Bananas on the 24th of February. I was invited to talk then. So I'm now going to read the second extract, which is half as long as the first one, and this one is set here in this country. None of our counsellors are available at the moment. We know it may be it can be difficult to ask for help. The accent was, of course, a New Zealand one, which it would be, or quite likely might be, this being a New Zealand helpline. Please hold the line, and one of our team will be with you as soon as they can. If you'd like us to call you back, was the accent comforting to hear because it was familiar, or was it strange to hear? Please press 1. You will not lose your place in the queue. If you are concerned about yourself or about someone else's immediate safety, please hang up and dial 111. And then, was it Bach? Classical piano music, in any case, about a minute of it, until none of our counsellors are available at the moment. We know, and tinkly piano music, Bach or something else, Baroque, Purcell, more likely Bach, The Art of Fugue or something. Oh, by the way, as I'm reading this, I've got these, you can sort of see that it's music on the page, but I can't read it. I mean, I'm not, or
no,
something.
You want to sing it.
No, I didn't practice it. Would have been a good idea. Or something similar. None of our counsellors are available at the moment. We know, or something similar. None of our counsellors are available at the moment. We know Bach would be her guess, or what was it? None of our counsellors are available at the moment. We know, now it was something else, the slow movement of a concerto, Schubert, or Mozart, or country music would be a no-no in this context, clearly, aside from all the words. When Googling music to die to the other day, she'd come across an article about suicide and country music. It made a lot of sense, all the gloomy lyrics. But anyway, she was more into, well, she quite liked classical, so this was good. It was pleasant, like your own free-to-call phone concert, aside from the once-a-minute vocal interruptions. Each time they happened, she kept thinking she was about to talk, to speak to someone, which was a bit unnerving. Plus, it was none is, not are, available at the moment if she was going to be picky, but none of our counsellors are is available at the moment. We know it turned out to be a recording. As time went on, 3, 4, 5 minutes, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, she felt more and more on edge at the prospect of talking to someone. Kia ora, tautoko, a woman said, or she said something like that. It gave Franny a fright. Hello, Franny said, kia ora. She wasn't sure whether she was supposed to, or whether this would just be triage and she'd be referred to someone else, but in the meantime, she launched in. She said that her sister, who was here on unpaid leave from London, she'd been getting messages from her that she was looking into ways, just out of interest, she said, and she'd been doing that for a while now, telling her about various websites she'd been Googling. Franny said she'd been meaning to call Tautoko and that she had in fact called the Samaritans on her sister's behalf late last year, and they said her sister needed to call them. She sent her sister all the numbers she could call quite a few times, and then 3 days ago her sister said, I wish I was with M. Who's dead? Franny specified. The woman, who would be answering from an office in Auckland, probably, since that was where the helpline was based, or was it? Let Franny spill out all this stuff about her sister, not interrupting, but just saying, yeah, yeah, and mm-hmm, and Yeah. And then when Franny stopped talking, concluding with, "So I'm just wondering what else I should be doing." "It sounds like you are doing everything you can," the woman said. "Is there anything else I could be doing?" "No, nothing." "Nothing? I suppose she has to want help." "It sounds like it is quite a weight for you," the woman said, "having her keep telling you all this." "It's fine. I wouldn't want her to feel she couldn't talk to me. I'd feel worse if she didn't ever call." "No, but she needs to know how it makes you feel, because it can drag you down listening to that." "Yeah. She needs to be aware of the weight of responsibility you're feeling." "She needs to be aware of that." "Yeah. The sense of responsibility. She needs to be responsible. She's an adult. She needs to take responsibility and get help. You need to tell her how you're feeling. So, when you talk to me like that about wanting to be with M, for example, I feel, and, when M died around 2 years ago, my sister was very interested. She wanted to know how, because she's very unhappy, and I suppose it's in the air. "What's your name?" the woman said. "Oh, Florence," Franny said. "Well, Florence," the woman said, "that does make sense," she said, or something similar. Franny was too busy recentering herself to listen properly, but, "Oh, and what's your name?" Franny asked, to be polite. The woman said her name, that was or wasn't her name, and Franny said, "You probably told me that at the beginning of the call, but I didn't hear," in that she wasn't listening. And then the woman said, "I'm concerned about you. How are you? Are you okay?" That was kind, but, "Oh, thank you. Yes, I am. I'm okay." "You are okay. That's what you're telling me." "Yes, really. You are okay." What a question. And what if she said she wasn't? What would happen next? "No, I've got plenty of support." "Okay. But if you did ever want to call to speak to someone for yourself, there's no need to sit there pondering. Just call." "Thank you," Franny said, "but I've got a lot of support," she thought she'd better add once more. "And that's just it. I don't know how my sister survives without support," she meant. But the woman, whose name Franny had forgotten, had got that. She said, "It sounds like depression." "Yep. And that needs to be assessed. It's not about you mothering your sister. It's about being assertive and letting her know that what she keeps telling you has an impact, all those calls. She has to be aware of what she's doing, because if she keeps telling you about those websites and what she is thinking about, it can really be a weight on you. She needs to go to her GP. She needs to get a counselor, and you need evidence that she's going to a counselor. You need evidence that some support is happening. That was, how long had they been talking? Half an hour perhaps? Or 15 minutes? Anyway, perhaps she should be thinking of ending the call now, so as not to clog up the line for other callers. "Well, thank you so much," Franny said. The woman said something that meant it was fine to call back any time. So that was the second reading from the two readings. Thank you. And so that was the second part from the second part of Parallel Hell. I don't have a publication date. Someone's already asked me about that. I wish I did. But when I do, I'll be announcing it on my blog, Farlane on French Writers. So if you subscribe to the newsletter, you'd get a newsletter once a month. And within that newsletter, I hope that you will eventually have an email with me announcing not just videos that I occasionally do or my monthly review, but that the book has a publication date, and then anyone who's on the newsletter at that point will go into a draw to receive a signed copy in the post. Thank you very much for coming here to listen to this, and I would love to have any questions if you do have any.
I'll get in first. Interesting that you came back to Aotearoa to write something about suicide, given the astronomically dreadful high rate of suicides in this country.
It's not linked. It just happens to be, as you say, true. And yeah.
You just wanted to come home for a year.
No, it was for family reasons. My partner had family reasons, so we came back for that reason. So, yeah.
Those conversations sound so believable. Did you actually ring up and see what they say?
I've got a couple of friends in London, so these are London-based, who work for the... Well, not work, volunteers for the Samaritans. So I've asked them, how do you generally take questions? They were general questions. I asked them about training and so, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to ask if you talked to Marilyn about this book.
Yes, my mother. Yes, so she had a sneak preview of this evening. I printed it off because I'm staying at hers at the moment. So, yeah, so she hasn't read the book, but she's read this section, I think, or part of it.
And as one of New Zealand's major novelists, what does your mother think of this book, your book?
Well, she hasn't read it yet, so she's been complimentary about the little bits that she has read, which is great. Yeah.
Why suicide? Why did you decide to write a book about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I suppose
not
you...
Very cheery.
No, you, no. And it's interesting that Vidisha, you know, said that about Dorothy Parker, because I didn't know when she said that I was going to then write about suicide. But, I write about what I'm obsessed about, and which is what a lot of writers do. This is fiction, but I always take a subject that I'm obsessed about, and, yeah, unfortunately it's a subject that I became obsessed about.
Why?
Why? Well, I think probably obsession. I think you have to be obsessed. I'm not sure whether I'm understanding the question, but you have to be obsessed in order to write a book, because you're going to be spending at least a year on it, or two, or even longer. So I do have to be obsessed. Yeah.
Did something trigger it?
Yeah, something took that. Well, you can't really arrive at my age without knowing people who have been going through those experiences, or, you know, have ended their life by suicide, or have been having ideas around suicide. I mean, even in my teens, I knew people. Yeah.
But there's a difference between being suicide obsessed and suicidal.
Yes, yeah.
And do you think that actually your characters, or your character is more suicide obsessed or suicidal?
Well,
because I mean, these sort of phone calls, if someone was really suicidal, could be absolutely catastrophic.
It's really for the reader to decide what they think as they read the book, because I'm only giving you tiny things, tiny extracts from the novel. So she's definitely suicide obsessed. For the rest, you'd have to read the novel to come to your own conclusion. Yeah.
What is your relationship with the character now? Have you farewelled
her? Yeah. Yeah, and the novel's finished. So I have farewelled her in that sense. Yeah, I'm not living it. Yeah.
Do you feel you've dealt with your own suicide obsession?
It's finished with now that you finished the novel?
My obsession with suicide, on the subject, my obsession with the subject has not finished. I'm interested in the subject forever. I read a lot of interesting books actually, about it. David Vann, I don't know whether you've read, his writing, Halibut on the Moon, which was shortlisted for the Occam, and non-fiction, Why Suicide is a really beautiful, short book, really helpful, by a man whose father ended his life, and, he's put out a second edition quite recently, which he changed it. Yes, I've read some books that I really didn't like. I didn't like their tone, I didn't like their take, and other books that I really did like, I found helpful and useful and interesting, but yeah, I'm not an academic, you know, yeah, neither is my main character, so.
I've got another question, if I'm allowed more than one.
Go for it.
Something that I notice a lot these days that I didn't notice when I was young, is that there's a lot of talk about the high rates of what gets called suicidality amongst LGBT youth, and that it's this massive thing that, you know, and I'm kind of wondering, do you have any sort of insights into that or views on that? Because I don't recall that being such a big thing when I was young. I don't remember, you know, it's almost as if nowadays, if you're, you know, a lesbian, for example, you're supposedly going to have this kind of innate likelihood of being suicidal.
Yeah.
Did you come across anything like that in your work?
What I am... One example, and it isn't, comes up in the novel, there's a novelist called, Taiwanese novelist, who died by suicide in the 1990s in Paris. And, I have mixed feelings about the work actually that there, but she was a lesbian, and she went to a school with some girls who were filmed by someone who went into a lesbian nightclub and filmed them without their knowing it. And that contributed, and I wouldn't say led to, because it's always complex, but contributed anything that's a hard experience, I suppose. People treating you badly because of who you are, any reasons that make life more difficult.
If I could just comment from that, 20 odd years ago, or thereabouts, and certainly prior to that time, suicide was a banned topic. People weren't allowed to write about it in newspapers, talk about it on radio or
you
TV.
You can't report a death as a suicide.
No, absolutely
you
not.
Can't.
Yeah, exactly.
You still can't say, yeah. There are no suspicious circumstances.
That, yeah. But it was absolutely led tightly on and wrapped up in a big bundle sort of thing. Whereas, and then being a lesbian or gay guy or whatever other, you know, combinations one might feel, that was also fairly much not spoken about either, you know. And so we had, you know, law reform, and we had lots more activity around queer rights and so on and so forth. And still we have the very high suicide rate. It's not that it wasn't necessarily similar back then. It was just that we never got to hear about it.
Do you think that's it, Cal?
I think so, yes.
Because I wonder about that, because what gets reported... I know we're getting a bit away from your book, man.
It's not really
it is
a
subject. Subject, and yeah. Particularly because these things are said about our community these days. Mm. And I kind of wonder, you know, they talk about... I think there's a survey called Youth 12 or something that says that, you know, LGBT youth have elevated rates of thinking about suicide. So I kind of think, do we actually have elevated rates of actual suicide? I don't know. Or do we just have young people who say, oh, I feel so terrible, I think about killing myself, which is quite a different thing.
I looked into that question a bit here, actually, before coming tonight, because I thought, oh, I really need to be a bit more aware. I mean, I've been reading a lot about it, but I couldn't find a clear answer to that. There are statistics, you know, that there are, you know, what is it, three, this is where I'm really not good at statistics, it won't help, but sort of for every one woman who ends her life, there are three men who will. Yes. You know, there are those sort of statistics, and I don't know the ones for LGBT related.
No, I haven't seen anything reported at all that gets reported at this elevated level of suicidal ideation.
Well, to know what's going on with the young people, you have to be one of them. They're not going to be coming to us and telling us, are they?
Well, that's not what I'm getting at, really.
It's not to do with age so much, is it just to do with, yeah, a group? But, you know, the suicide was illegal in the UK and here until 1961, whereas now the Homosexual Law Reform Bill, when did that happen? Much later, 80, yeah, I mean, I know I was around, you know, I was here, I was there. yeah, so those sorts of, it's interesting to know the dates of when things change. I should have given, sorry.
Oh, is your protagonist lesbian?
Yes, so you would need to read the book and make the decision for yourself. That's a strange answer perhaps, but yes, I mean there aren't a lot of lesbian specific references in the book. There is just that novelist, Chiu Miao Jin, the Taiwanese novelist, who turns up, because of course, this main character is reading everything she can find. Yeah.
I mean, this, I know you, but can I ask a question? Why would someone want to read this book? Because it's about suicide, and it's not cheerful. Like,
yeah.
People read. Why would someone, and your, if you can answer that.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to throw that back to everyone. Why would you want to read this? But I mean, if I was going to answer it, I would hope that it would lead to people having more understanding, more empathy. It really is like a deep dive into a suicidal mind. I'm, you know, suicide obsessed, suicidal mind, you know, anyone who's just so in it. So I would hope that it would lead to more empathy, if not for the main character, but for all of the information, because it's just dense with the subject, but it doesn't romanticize it at all, obviously, but I'll just say that. I mean, that's one of the things that Samaritans don't like you to do if you're writing a book. You don't romanticize it, but that's the last thing I'll be doing. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't, even after a page into the book, you're not going to be thinking anything, you know, it's not. You had a question. Sorry, did you? Oh, I thought you did. No. Oh, you didn't, sorry. Yeah, oh, you did, sorry.
Okay, this is a tough question that you might not want to answer, and you're very welcome not to, but you just said that it's a dive into the mind of someone who's felt suicidal, which is quite a big thing to say.
Well, suicide obsessed. Yeah, I might rephrase that.
Okay, because it's like, oh, this might help you understand if you're actually in their mind. Do you feel you felt that serious yourself, suicidal, and you don't have to answer, but...
I think I'm lucky enough not to have got to that terrible place. I know what it is to feel awful. And I think, I mean, that's a fairly bland word, isn't it? But, you know, I've been in bad places, hard places, and I don't think that's much of a self-reveal, is that the word, to say that? Because most people have.
But not on the verge of suicide.
Right, yeah.
I love that quote from somebody talking to a counsellor on the phone, counsellor. I hadn't thought that the greetings Kia ora would startle somebody, because I'm Kiwi, so I'm so used to it. But I hadn't thought of somebody from another country ringing in.
No, actually, she was not startled by the Kia ora. She was startled by the fact that the woman was speaking. Yeah, it wasn't that, it was just the fact that suddenly there was someone on the phone. Yeah.
Yeah, but that extract was so true to life. That, our counsellors are all busy at the moment. Oh, no, yes. Yeah.
No matter what the topic.
Exactly.
What will the next book be?
Oh, I have started it, and I can't talk about it because I've only written a few thousand words, so then that's not a good idea. Yeah. It will be growing as the book goes, honestly. growing a growing obsession. Thank you so much for coming to listen to me, everyone. Yeah. And thanks for inviting me, Carol, and Ellen. Thank you.
Thank you.